Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Angharad Parekh. And coming up, how long before inflation gets back to 2%? And then what? Could record rainfall send food prices soaring and leave our supermarket shelves empty? Also say new ISA rules have come in, but will your bank let you benefit? How much does your supermarket charge for a bag, and what do they get out of it? And Woodford is back. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the latest inflation figures came out this week showing that CPI is edging closer to the Bank of England's 2% target, following another drop to 3.2% from 3.4%. Compare that to this time last year, where it stood at 10.1%. Now, while the direction of travel is positive, the speed of late has some concern. So how long will it take for inflation to fall to the 2% target? And what will happen when we get there? Simon, Ang, welcome. Ang, to you first. Good news. Why is inflation falling?
Yeah, so the headline rate has gone from 3.4 to 3.2, and that is majorly down to a fall in food prices. So we're in our 12th consecutive month now of the price of food falling. So that's been a major kind of contributor. The core inflation, so not food and also not energy and alcohol, also fell. So that's not as much as the headline rate, but it's at 4.2, and that's down from 4.5% last month. So it's good news on the food prices front. I mean, obviously prices are still rising, but they're just not rising as quickly. And then we've also got kind of rising fuel prices, which is sort of partially offsetting that downward contribution.
Well, never one to rest on our good news laurels for long. Oh, we'll get back to food prices potentially going up a little bit later on. But Simon, when will it reach 2%? Just remind us of the 2% target. Any particular reason 2%?
No real reason that it's 2%, apart from the fact that it's been 2% for ages. And there is a discussion about whether you should change the inflation target depending on what's going on in the world. So, for example, if we go back to the early 2000s when we were importing disinflation, so we were in a scenario where, you know, China was pumping out loads of cheap goods, there was lots of money, there was lots of sort of money trying to find a home around the world, everything was like pushing prices down, then we maybe should have had an inflation target that was different to the 2%. And slightly lower. And then there's an argument that in a world now where everybody's reshoring, pulling stuff back to making stuff closer to home due to global political concerns, also the post-COVID landscape where there was a massive supply shock and people have decided that just-in-time manufacturing isn't quite the be-all and end-all that they thought it was, that maybe the inflation target should be slightly higher. And then there's an argument that you should just stick with the same number, because once you start messing with it, you can start moving it around to suit the political will. So it's 2%, right? That's considered to be just enough inflation for the economy to be moving along nicely, because you don't want to have it at zero, the argument goes, because then your policies will be too restrictive and they will stifle growth. And you don't want to have it too high, because then inflation risks running away with itself. So that's why we've got the 2%. When are we going to get back to it? Andrew Bailey, the boss of the Bank of England, reckons there's going to be a big drop in inflation next month. This is due to the comparative decline in energy prices due to the new energy price cap kicking in. If that's true, then we could get back to 2% at some point over the summer. Depending on what economist you listen to, it may be 2% as spring turns into summer, or it may be 2% as summer turns into autumn. And if you can find a real pessimist out there, we'll still be waiting for 2% in winter.
Right. And then what? Yay, we can all go home.
Well, that's the $1 million question, isn't it?
Mm.
Because there's quite a degree of division in the then what answer. So one side of the then what is that actually the sharp rise in interest rates hasn't completely fed through to the economy yet. The effect of raising interest rates lags. It's a very blunt tool. It's a tool that's been blunted even further by the big increase in fixed rate mortgages compared to, you know, go back to the early 1990s when there was hardly any fixed rate mortgages, which means that the effect on people is lumpy. You've got less mortgaged homeowners. So you've got lots of homeowners at the top end who don't have a mortgage anymore. Then you have more people renting who don't have a mortgage either. Their landlords might have a mortgage, but their landlords might not have a mortgage. So the feed through there is different. And then you've got the people in the middle, and the people in the middle are being hit in a very lumpy way because their rates don't change immediately. Their rates change when they come off their fixed rate deal. And all of a sudden, they start having to pay £500 or £600 a month more. And then it's very, very painful. Businesses are being directly affected by this. They don't tend to have the same lumpy element that homeowners do. And then there's other parts of the economy where it's being affected. So there's a question of whether the impact is going to be greater than we think, and that we've reduced the money supply and inflation is going to crash down through the 2% and then keep going lower and maybe even head towards 0%. There's not many people out there predicting deflation, which is inflation below 0%, i.e. it going down. But there's quite a lot of people predicting a disinflationary scenario, which is like very low inflation. On the other hand, you've got people predicting second order inflation, where all of a sudden inflation comes back round and bites us in the arse. There's no other way of saying it, is there, really? That actually we've had the first round of people demanding more money, businesses putting up prices, all that kind of stuff, and we're about to get the second round of it. Dragged it down, put a lid on it. Actually, the price of most stuff is still going up. It's not going down. And then they're going to go, right, okay, we're going to get a bit more. I would point to a place where I think that you can see this occurring. Airline prices, airfares. Airfares are quite expensive at the moment, I think. You look at airfares for summer or going beyond that, and it's difficult to tell exactly what's going on here. Have they not released all the seats, for example? You know, but even then, that means that they're keeping prices higher by doing that, testing the waters, seeing if they can get away with it. But if you look at airfares for the summer and going like towards the end of the year, they're coming in really quite high. They feel quite high. There's not many cheap deals out there. If you go back a year, I think they look cheaper. If you go back 2 years, they obviously look much cheaper. And that's like a little example of this second order effect where airlines are going, we've got quite a lot of demand here. We reckon we can get away with higher prices. Let's bump the prices up, see what happens, because we can always put them back down again. But let's test the waters. And that feeds through, you know, into higher inflation, because it's going to feed through into airfares looking higher than they were a year ago. I think we're seeing some of it with the branded goods makers. So obviously we've had food inflation, you know, falling, as Ang said. But, you know, the price of branded goods, you see that, you know, still very high. So I think there is potentially, you know, an argument that we might see another bout of inflation.
If we do, Ang, could the Bank of England raise rates?
I mean, yeah, in theory they can. I think it would be probably quite unlikely. I mean, obviously it all sort of depends on where inflation goes. I mean, I think the main concern now at the minute among economists is that if inflation, you know, although it's falling, it's not falling as quickly as maybe we anticipated. And if it is sticky and kind of stays around the 3% mark as it is in the US, then they could stay higher for longer. So I'd say it's probably more likely that they stay at their current rates rather than being cut or raised anytime soon. And I think the bank also has to kind of, it's not just inflation. Wage growth is also kind of well above forecast. So that's kind of something else that they sort of need to take into account. So I think, you know, the bank's been very cautious. It's kind of signalling when it might come. I think, you know, as Simon says, the general kind of consensus is that inflation will reach the target at some point this summer. you know, most economists think that we'll probably see a reduction at some point, possibly in August rather than June, which had been sort of widely predicted. But also, I think it kind of depends also on what the Federal Reserve do. You know, we have tended to wait to see what the US is doing. I mean, we might be the first to go, but it's probably more likely that they will wait until kind of September time to cut rates over there.
And we talked about food a little bit earlier, food prices falling, but something else that could put a spanner in the works of falling inflation is the not so great British weather. We've had record rainfall in the last 18 months or near record rainfall, and we are not alone. Other countries, including those from which we import goods, have experienced extreme temperatures over the last couple of years affecting harvest. So could we start to see food prices soar again, Ang, and empty shelves?
Yeah, the rain has been a real nuisance. I think most of us will agree, but it's really, really affecting British farms. So I spoke to some farmers this week about the kind of the impact it's having. It's not really something that new. I think they've been dealing with, you know, this extreme weather for some time, and it really makes it difficult for them to get anything in the ground. So one person that I spoke to said that he's, you know, only able to plant 10 to 15% of his crops this season. And I think that's being replicated across the country. You know, wheat, barley, oilseed rape, they're all really suffering. And, you know, this summer, I think yields are expected to be down by quite a significant margin. And I think that the main issue with all of this kind of extreme weather is obviously the immediate impact, but there's just been no let up. We've had so many storms. I'm not even sure what storm we're on now. But last autumn, there was one particularly bad one, which really, really damaged kind of farmers and had real financial implications. And some of them are still dealing with it. You know, some farmers can't get back into their fields and they're just waiting for them to dry. And then we have this ridiculous rainfall in the last kind of month or so. So it's really, really difficult. We do import half of our food. So we kind of need to look at the countries that we import from. The issue there is that they're also suffering with extreme weather. So places like Kenya, where we get a lot of our coffee, there's been lots of rainfall. Tea producers in India facing the same. And then we've got droughts across kind of West Africa and Latin America. So there are warnings that we could kind of start facing shortages of staples like bananas and avocados and tea and coffee. So that kind of puts a strain on domestic production and the supermarkets and how they kind of bridge that gap.
This is where I feel some affinity with my Nordic roots. I love anything that's pickled, fermented or canned. So I'm absolutely fine. Are we going to see shortages at shelves of anything pickled, fermented or canned?
I'm not sure on the pickled side. I think right. With fresh, I think you'll be fine.
Great. As long as I'm all right. But what about fresh stuff? What are we likely to see?
Fresh stuff. I don't think we'll see them in the immediate term. These things take a bit of time to kind of filter through. I think, you know, our supermarkets are really good at plugging the gaps when these sort of things happen. I know last year we had some shortages of kind of tomatoes and eggs and cucumbers, but, you know, it actually in the grand scheme of things wasn't that bad and wasn't actually for too long. I think there is definitely a risk that we could face them in the future and it happening more regularly. I think, you know, the systems that we've got in place are working, but there will come a point where farmers can't deal with it anymore. Supermarkets can't cope. The farmers I spoke to this week say they need to have kind of more of their profits so that they can invest in systems to prevent the worst of this weather affecting crops. But grocers aren't going to like that. It could mean price rises that will feed through to the consumers. So yeah, none of it is ideal. And, you know, it might be that we have to kind of start thinking about the food that we eat, whether that be kind of seasonally. We could end up growing more here if the weather gets warmer, but it is these sort of extreme weather events that are the real issue because you just can't plan around them.
I don't think any of what you said is not sensible to start thinking about how we eat. One story you have on your website combining inflation and I suppose food stuff, craft beer. Do you remember the boom in craft beer? Everyone was drinking it. Not everyone, obviously, but lots of people were. Apparently, life is grim now for the industry. What's going on there?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like that many people are drinking it as much anymore. So last year, the number of breweries filing for insolvency jumped 49%, so from 35 to 52, which doesn't sound like that many, but there are just over 1,000 of these kind of small breweries. So it is a fair amount. I think as with anything, it's rising costs and lower demand. So a lot of them have relied on sort of debt financing for equipment and materials, which have obviously risen, and the debt's just become unmanageable. I also think that the price of craft beer is always so much more expensive than your average lager. And I think it's probably one of the first things to go when people are cutting back on their spend. And a lot of it is less demand for drinking. I think people are drinking less, and a big route to market for a lot of these small independent breweries is through pubs. And, you know, they've got their own issues, closures reaching record highs, and they're less likely to take a risk on kind of these new funky beers and will go for the kind of Stellas and the Guinnesses. So it is really, really difficult for them at the moment. I think a lot bigger sort of breweries are buying up a lot of the smaller ones. So they're, you know, more likely to take up more room on supermarket shelves. So all in all, it's not great for craft breweries at the moment, especially the really small ones starting out.
Is that the case, Simon? Are we drinking less, and therefore are troubled times ahead for wine and beer, I suppose, and all sorts of alcoholic beverages?
I believe we may be drinking less. Yes, we are drinking less in pubs. Pubs are closing down. They're struggling with, you know, inflation, wages. It's just less socially acceptable to go down the pub for 2 hours of an evening and leave your family at home, which I think a lot of pubs, you know, if you go back 30 years, that was just like, you know, and it was men mainly.
Gastro men. Pubs
men. They, you know, they would stop in the pub on their way home from work for a couple of hours, or they'd come home, have dinner, and then go down the pub. I know that, you know, there's a village near me where the pub closed down some time ago, many years ago. It's a pub that, you know, we used to drink in when we were younger. And one of the, you know, the community tried to do one of these community buyouts. The person who owns it, you know, what, somebody wanted to turn it into a house, and then they now want to turn it into something else, like maybe keep part of it open as a pub and things like that. But one of the comments that was made, you know, and this is going back like at least 5 years, when I think this community buyout thing was going on, was somebody said, well, if half of the people on here complaining about how the pub's shut and saying they want to keep the pub open had actually gone into the pub, then the pub probably wouldn't have shut in the first place.
Right.
The issue is the breweries who own a lot of the pubs. The pub is worth much more if they can sell it to someone who can turn it into residential than it is to turn it into a pub, because running the pub isn't that profitable, particularly if you are a tied, you know, landlord. It's not very profitable. And then if you want to buy the building outright and then run it yourself, the cost of the property is so expensive that it's very difficult to make your money back in a way that is going to reward someone who is, you know, young, entrepreneurial, and in it to grow a business, rather than someone who's simply older and looking for a bit of a kind of income to supplement their other income. So the industry's in a bit of trouble. And it was held up by the fact that we all went mad for buying craft beer. Because it was different, wasn't it? It was like, oh, look, here's some new beers. But then, you know, with any new market like that, you get lots of new entrants come in. People see the opportunity to make some money. There were craft breweries cropping up all over the place. Some of them are going to survive. Some of them aren't going to survive. It might be they just don't make as much money as the person thought they were going to be. As Ang said, some of them expanded, used debt, price of servicing that debt went up. The cost of running their business went up, inflation, wages, all those other things. They're not making any money. They've folded. Others got bought out by big breweries. And maybe we just had too many of them in the first place. I mean, I personally think we can point some of the finger of blame at Madry. The Madry boom.
The alma of Madrid, the soul of Madrid.
The soul of Madrid that's never been to Madrid in its life. It's made in Tadcaster. Madry is one of the best kind of marketing business stories ever, right? It is literally the perfect case study for this kind of stuff. It was around before the pandemic, but it kind of like suddenly we came out of the pandemic and it was like, boom, everywhere was selling Madry. Everybody's buying Madry. The soul of Madrid, it, you know, it says on the beer, it, obviously it's got that Spanish, it's got a very Spanish looking guy. The bottle says Cerveza Excepcional, Madry Excepcional, that kind of thing. It's never been to Spain. It's not even been on holiday there.
No.
I mean, obviously somebody's probably taken a bottle there. I did hear a rumor that they had actually opened a bar in Madrid selling it so that they could say it was sold in Madrid. This may or may not be true. Please do not sue me, makers of Madry. It is brewed in Tadcaster by American-owned giant Molson Coors. And the branding is brilliant because it really captured a kind of like, yeah, I'm going to have some Madry. It's got that kind of Spanish new kind of feeling to it. They got it into all the pubs. Apparently, one of the great successes was they shipped out loads of those glasses to the pubs during the pandemic when they were shut.
I remember.
So when the pubs reopened, they all had Madry on tap and they had the glasses. And people love the glasses. It's like you forget about what a simple thing that is. But, you know, people think about, they like the glass they get the beer in. There was a huge success for Stella back in the day when Stella suddenly boomed. And obviously, you know, they flogged it into all the supermarkets and everything. And it just became this, you know, this kind of virtuous circle. And it's absolutely amazing in terms of that kind of, you know, boom. And I'm not just being facetious here, but, you know, for every person going to the bar and ordering, you know, 3 Madrys, please, and one of those, they might have been ordering 3 of those before. And so it eats into those craft beer sales, and the pub's like, well, craft beer was 2 years ago. Everybody's drinking Madry now. And I'm sure that will fade, obviously, because there was a point when everybody was drinking Stella. Although I think Stella might actually still be the country's biggest selling lager in pubs. I'm not quite sure whether that's true or not. But yeah, I think you've got to point some of the finger of blame at Madry.
Yeah, the Madry thing just reminds me how little people actually know about beer, because honestly it could be anything there. Did you remember Iker Casillas when he went to Newcastle and he said, well, I'm not going to say what he said, but he was outraged. WTF, I think he said, at the point of it being the soul of Madrid. I don't think so. Iker Casillas, of course, the goalkeeper for Real Madrid in the past. Right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now for our weekly Investing Explained feature by Daniel Beecroft of Charles Stanley Direct. Daniel, welcome to the podcast. A quick question for you. What does diversification mean for investors, and why is it important?
Well, quite simply, diversification is all about spreading your money around instead of putting all your eggs in one basket. So a diverse portfolio will have a variety of assets that will help to reduce risk. Different asset classes react differently to market conditions, and therefore having a mixture of equities, bonds, property, and cash should lessen any impact of a downturn in that sort of area. It's important for investors as it aims to manage risk and smooth the ups and downs of the markets. So it helps limit exposure to significant losses. However, it can have the limit to the extent of an upside. So the key thing to remember is that the purpose of diversification is not to maximize returns, but to minimize against downturns.
And it sounds complicated, but is there an easy way for investors to diversify?
So investors could try and create their own DIY portfolio and mix different assets and spread across different geographies and sectors. But this is going to be quite time consuming, it'll be expensive, and potentially they'll make costly mistakes. So an easy alternative would be multi-asset funds. This is a convenient option for those seeking a diverse portfolio as it combines different asset classes into a single, professionally managed fund with a fund manager who's responsible. They are ready-made portfolios for all types of risk profile and objectives, and it takes an awful lot of the guesswork from DIY investors. At Charles Stanley, we have a range of our own multi-asset funds, and you could find out more information on our website under Do It Yourself Investing.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You know who else is back? Neil Woodford. That's who. This time, as a Finfluencer. The Phoenix rose just a week after the city watchdog blasted the former fund manager's grasp of risk management, Simon. Neil Woodford. Who he? For anyone who doesn't know, perhaps they've had too many batteries, I don't know.
My name is Neil Woodford. I am 64 years old and I live in Southwest England. I've worked in the investment industry since the early 1980s. You may remember me as the fund manager who avoided the dot-com bubble and the banking crisis and delivered index-beating performance for over 25 years. Or perhaps as the disgraced fund manager who presided over Woodford Investment Management's collapse in 2019. Others may not have heard of me at all. Whatever your perspective, you may be curious about what I have to say about a wide range of economic, social, and political impact issues that impact our everyday lives. Unfortunately, much of the commentary I read about the UK economy is long on opinion, but critically short on data. It is often factually wrong, perhaps because established narratives are too willingly accepted. What is clearly severely lacking is data-supported information and analysis. Yes, he's back. Those are the opening paragraphs of Neil Woodford, 64, from Southwest England's new blog. And that is not his opening line for a round on Blind Date, where he's going to take someone out for a couple of madries afterwards. That is Neil Woodford putting his pin back in it and saying, I'm here, I've still got stuff of value to offer. Please ignore the bit where I crashed that massive equity income fund. And pay attention to the bit where I was really successful before that. Is anybody going to listen? Who knows? I mean, he's owning it in this blog. My own journey has had highs and lows. The financial media have variously described me as the man who made Middle England rich, or Britain's answer to Warren Buffett. In contrast, the failure of Woodford Investment Management in 2019 fed an altogether different narrative, transforming me from a hero to a villain in the eyes of many. With respect to my story, the truth is that I am neither hero nor villain. I was never the financial saviour of Middle England, but then neither do I think that I was worthy of the onslaught that followed the failure of my business. I think there's a lot of people in the comments on our story about this yesterday who disagree with that last statement.
Why? Why the villain? Put the cases on either side, Simon. You put the cases.
All right.
Hero or villain? Who is he?
All I'll say is he says there is much more to be revealed about the story. Dun, dun, dun. We shall wait eagerly for the next instalment of Mr. Woodford's blog, newsletter, Instagram posts, and all of the other things that he is bringing out. Neil Woodford made a lot of investors quite a lot of money for a very long time. And he's right. He made some good calls. And he was widely lauded in the financial press, including on This Is Money. And he did that off the back of an approach where he invested largely in big dividend paying, stable blue chip companies and stuck to his guns on the investments that he thought were best. He then left his employer, Invesco Perpetual, where he ran a ginormous fund that had made people lots of money, and opened up his own investment company, Woodford Investment Management, with a business partner. And initially, it did very, very well. I mean, the launch was very high profile, obviously, because he was Britain's superstar fund manager. And initially, he did very, very well for his investors. And the fund swelled to a very, very large size. But Neil Woodford had a passion project on the side, which was investing in exciting, smaller and sometimes unlisted companies. And these tend to be much more high risk. So he was combining running a sort of big equity income fund with risky small company investing and doing it in the same fund. And that's where he came unstuck, because when those bets didn't go right, and people started pulling money out and the performance suffered, because it's an investment fund, you have to be able to give people their money back immediately. People take money out, you have to sell investments to give them the money that it goes back out of. And you can get stuck in the scenario where you are a forced seller. And if you are investing in those kind of small, risky, potentially disruptive high growth companies, or potentially might go wrong and never make any money and go bust companies, you need to not be a forced seller. You need to be able to sit and wait and be patient, which is why he also ran an investment trust called Woodford Patient Capital, which was a much better vehicle for investing in that kind of thing, because an investment trust is listed on the stock market. It has shares that are traded on the stock market itself, and it isn't a forced seller in the same way, because if people sell out en masse of the investment trust, then the shares can fall to a discount to the net asset value of the trust. The trust doesn't have to sell investments to give people their money back. It can just allow the share price to fall, and the share price can be below what the supposed value of those investments are. So arguably, if Neil Woodford wanted to do what he was going to do, then he should have just stuck to doing it within the investment trust. He shouldn't have been doing it within the fund. In his defense, Neil Woodford was one of the few managers who published a full list of all of the investments that his fund held. So if you were an investor in his fund, which I was, then you could see exactly what he was holding. And if you engaged fully with that list, then you could sit there and think, hang on a minute, what is this guy doing? And is this a good move? And should I really be invested in this? Unfortunately, most people don't pay anywhere near enough attention to that kind of stuff. I didn't pay enough attention to it. I ended up locked in the fund when the gates got shut because there was a rush for the exit, and the fund administrators, who Neil Woodford blames for the crash. He blames the fund administrators Link for the crash, not his own investment decisions. I was locked in as well, and I lost money on it. But I would say, in investors' defense, that Woodford Equity Income, you know, it was very much, you know, sort of marketed to them, and they felt that it was very much like the old Woodford, you know, not the Woodford Equity Income, but the old one that he used to run, full of blue chip investments and that kind of stuff. And I think if Neil Woodford's entirely honest with himself, he knew that all those investors didn't have all that money in his fund because they wanted to be backing high risk speculative companies. They wanted to be backing the kind of companies that, you know, he made his name backing. And that's what they thought that they were backing. So I think that, you know, he ultimately is the person to blame for this, whatever defense he offers up. I think he's entitled to offer up his defense. And I think he can make a reasonable defense for some of it. But at the end of the day, he was making money hand over fist here. The investors lost out, and those investors thought that they were invested in something that they weren't. And that fund was entirely the wrong investment vehicle for Neil Woodford to be pursuing the passion project that he was pursuing.
Forgive me, and I say this without, you know, judgment on either side. I'm just curious. When you invest in a fund with a famous name attached to it, and there are many, are you not to a degree investing in the manager of that fund and the decisions that they make, sort of a bit like an American politician? Don't you vote for them so that they go and make decisions? Otherwise, well, you'd just stick it in a tracker, right? Or you'd make those decisions yourself. With a fund manager, don't you sort of trust that they will take you further than you could take yourself? So even if you can see where he's invested, you'd think, well, you know, he's a smart man, he knows more than I do, and that's why I'm giving him my money. No?
Yeah, I think so. I would argue that's the case. And you could say, well, he must be right. He's the investment genius and I'm not.
And sometimes people aren't right. So he's he's neither hero nor villain. He did okay for a while and didn't do okay for a while.
And sometimes you can end up right in the long run, the short run. But that comes back to my point of this is an in, it's not the right place to be doing this kind of investing. The investment trust was exactly the right place to be doing that kind of investing. There's a reason why investment trusts are better suited to some things like that, you know, what he was doing, the disruptive companies. It's Scottish Mortgage is an investment trust, right? And Scottish Mortgage as an investment trust believes in, you know, disruptive companies, companies that are going to change the world in 5 to 10 years time. Not all of them are going to pay out. Asymmetry of returns. Lots of them are going to fall along the wayside, but the ones that do well are going to do so well and have such outsized returns that it dwarfs the, you know, the failure rate and so on. And they want their investors to be patient and to stick with them. And that has been Scottish Mortgage's argument throughout the period of underperformance that it has had since doing very, 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 very well. And because Scottish Mortgage is an investment trust, it's not going to be a forced seller. So Scottish Mortgage, very, very big, you know, loads of people invested in it. But if loads of those people rush for the exit, all that happens is the share price falls and it falls to a discount to the net asset value. And as long as they're happy to sit there and allow it to run at a discount, then that's fine. There's been some arguments over it recently. Activist investors want to narrow that discount, all that kind of stuff. But they can just sit there. They can just go, right, fine. As a fund, I don't think that would be a good move. And I think that, you know, that's the fundamental issue here. And maybe that's something that's like, for the mainstream investor, edging towards the too complicated stuff. So then whose responsibility is it to be saying, actually, what we're doing here is too complicated for maybe a big chunk of the people that we've got invested in this fund. And if we're honest with ourselves, we don't genuinely think that they know exactly what we're doing here and exactly what they're backing. I would argue that responsibility lay with Neil Woodford and Craig Newman, the two people involved in running that fund and running that business. And I don't think Neil Woodford's fully owned that ever since it happened.
Well, the City Watchdog said that he didn't have the greatest grasp of risk management. I've paraphrased there, obviously. So they weren't big fans of this. But Simon, big question is, what's a finfluencer?
So it's people who pop up on Instagram and TikTok telling you cash stuffing and things like that.
All right.
Look, this is a blog and a newsletter and that kind of thing. There was talk that he was going to come back with a fund or a fund located somewhere else or that kind of thing. But this is a kind of like, here I am, I'm going to talk about this stuff. I mean, is it going to be a paid for newsletter? I don't know. It's not entirely clear yet. I think it's going to be free, but you can subscribe to receive Woodford views in your inbox.
Like a journalist.
Yeah. Just like writing about investing and stuff. And maybe he's going to be doing some, you know, selling analysis. I don't know what he's going to be doing. I know that he probably doesn't need lots of money. So
no,
but he also probably thinks he still has something to offer and wants to offer that and wants to kind of, you know, redeem himself and remake his name. But if you want to know what he's going to say, you can subscribe to receive Woodford Views in your inbox. The irony is that off the back of this, like Woodford Views, it's got far more traffic to it yesterday than it, like if, you know, 98% of the world had decided to launch an investing blog or newsletter. We're talking about it now.
Yeah, exactly.
There's going to be people listening to this who are going to go Google it and go read it and sign up to his newsletter. And it's that's going to ultimately make it successful in that way, isn't it?
So that's another watch this space. See what he comes out with. See what he does next. I'm sure we'll be on it. Moving on, though, I do want to talk about the major shakeup to ISAs that we saw this month. Now, it was meant to make the tax-efficient savings accounts even more attractive. However, it doesn't look like the major savings providers have kept up. One big bank, Barclays, for example, hasn't made any of the government's three major changes. So firstly, what are the changes? What's happening to ISAs? Or what's happened to ISAs?
Well, you'd think this was simple, wouldn't you? So the rules with ISAs were, you've got a £20,000 annual allowance. You can invest that across a stocks and shares ISA or a cash ISA as you like, any proportion into either. But you can only pay new money in each tax year into one type of each ISA. So to take an example, were you to open an ISA with Charles Stanley direct and pay money into that ISA, then you could not also, under the previous rules, open an ISA with Hargreaves Lansdown, Interactive Investor, AJ Bell, Free Trade, Trading 212, et cetera, and pay money into that in the same tax year. If you were to open a cash ISA with Nationwide Building Society, you could pay money into that, but you couldn't also open a cash ISA with Yorkshire Building Society and pay some money into that, even if you stuck below the £20,000 allowance. I have long argued that this is a problem. It's to consumer detriment because it means that consumers don't have the free choice that they should have. It's to their financial detriment, particularly involving cash ISAs, where, for example, you couldn't say, I'm going to put X amount into a easy access cash ISA and X amount into a fixed rate cash ISA. And it helps to keep fees high on things like investing platforms because they know they've effectively got a bit of a captive market because, you know, once you put your money in that year, you can't put any new money into a competitor and so on. This was all meant to change from the start of April. And you were going to be able to put as much money into as many different kinds of ISA as you liked, as long as you stuck below your £20,000 allowance. So in theory, you could open 20,000 cash ISAs and put a pound in each. I mean, in practice, you couldn't, but in theory, you could.
Sort of impractical as well.
Now, as with many things in life, you would think that this was a relatively simple scenario. And all that would happen is that you could now open a Yorkshire Building Society ISA, a Nationwide cash ISA, a Barclays cash ISA, and so on. And nobody ever need worry about it. And nobody at any of those banks or building societies would need to tell you, I'm sorry, you can't open this because you've already opened one elsewhere. In practice, the system seems to operate much like free bus passes, where the free bus pass system, you would think that they just let pensioners on the bus for free, but they don't just let pensioners on the bus for free. They give the bus companies some money based on how many pensioners that they think are going to get the bus, and then they go around in circles doing this. So there's a system behind ISAs whereby the banks and building societies are meant to keep tabs on whether you're busting your ISA limit.
Well, yeah, that
because
makes sense.
They're meant to be running systems where they're keeping tabs on how many ISAs you've opened and whether you're busting your ISA limit. That means that they are in a position to say to you, I'm sorry, Sunshine, I don't care what the new rules say. We cannot let you open an ISA with us if you've told us that you've opened an ISA with somebody else in this tax year. So when you open an ISA, they'll say, have you paid any money into a cash ISA with somebody else this tax year or something like that? And if you say yes to that, they'll say, sorry, you can't have this one, even though the rules mean that actually you should be able to have that one.
You say it's simple, Simon, but who's to monitor how much you put into each one? Well, I suppose it's the same system anyway, isn't it? Because you've got 20,000 you can put across any ISA. So how did they do it in the past?
Well, the bigger problem appears to be from Sylvia asking the banks that a lot of the big banks are allowing customers to open an ISA, even if they have one with another provider this year. Barclays stands out as not doing that. Aldermore says they're not doing that. Paragon says they're not doing that. And actually, once you move further down the scale, there's probably going to be loads more saying that.
Indefinitely
they're not doing that.
Or just now?
Only just for now.
Right.
Okay. Lots of them are saying that they won't allow customers to open both a fixed rate and easy access cash ISA with themselves. So, for example, Barclays, HSBC, Halifax, Lloyds, NatWest, Santander, no. And then partial transfers in and out are also the thing that's causing a big problem. This was another rule that you're allowed to make a partial transfer in and out. Previously, you could only if you paid money into an ISA that tax, you could only transfer all of that money. You couldn't transfer some of it. I guess it's an example where the Chancellor announces rules and then the rules come in before the banks and building societies are ready for them. But it also shines a light on some of this stuff that banks and building societies do complain about how there's more complexity behind the scenes than people realise.
Are there any actually doing all of the changes?
Yeah, I'm looking at the table here in the story. There will be more who are doing all the changes, but we just don't have them in the table because obviously we couldn't list every single bank and building society. But I'm going to say hats off to Skipton Building Society, which has managed to score 3 yeses.
Oh, fantastic. Well done.
Allows partial transfers in and out. Yes. Allows customers to open both a fixed rate and easy access cash ISA. Yes. Allows customers to open an ISA even if they have one with another provider this year. Yes. It does have an asterisk next to allow partial transfers in and out. Transfers in only, you have to move all of your Skipton Building Society out. Correct, as of 15th of April, 2024.
Oh, well done, Skipton, then. Right, Finally, when the government introduced the plastic bag charge in 2015, God, can you believe it was that long ago? It was intended to cut unnecessary plastic waste by encouraging us to reuse our bags. But we've come a long way, haven't we, from the 5p charge for a single-use plastic carrier bag at large retailers. Some retailers are charging way more than that, and do not get me started on, yes, I'm looking at you, Boots, for charging for paper bags that rip as soon as you are out the store. Do you know how much energy it uses up to create paper bags that you then just chuck away just because they're paper doesn't make it right? So where does our money actually go? And is the scheme actually working? And firstly, a history of the plastic bag charge.
Yeah, so the government introduced it in 2015, and it was for single-use plastic bags, which, to be honest, I don't think anyone really uses anymore. We've all kind of got used to the bags for life. So the idea was that we'd kind of slowly phase it out, which has worked. The kind of recent stats show that we've significantly reduced that bag usage. So in 2015, it was just large retailers that were advised to charge customers. So basically supermarkets and kind of Boots and sort of fashion retailers. And then this was doubled to 10p in 2021. And it then includes all businesses, so your kind of corner shops and that sort of thing. But as you say, recently, the price just seems to have soared. I don't remember the last time I was charged 10p for a bag. So I asked all of the retailers how much they now charge. And it's now up to four times the amount the government recommended. I think the key point is that although the government introduced it in 2015, it's not a law. So the supermarkets can basically charge what they want. They were advised, obviously, to donate the kind of proceeds of that to charitable causes.
So they don't have to donate to charity?
I think they're strongly advised to. And most do, to be fair to them. But, I mean, the prices have gone up so much. I mean, Tesco and Sainsbury's, it's now, I think they raised it recently from 20p to 30p. Asda and Aldi charge 30p. Lidl's even more expensive, 38p. And then we've got the whole range of sort of reusable options that they've all introduced, which can go up to £5.
Yeah, Waitrose, £5, yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's obviously a great thing. I think we should all be using kind of fewer plastic bags. But I think if you're caught out and then you end up having to pay, you know, £2.50 or whatever for a big shop, I think it's really, really unfair, especially since food prices are extortionate. And as you said, the paper bag thing is just ridiculous. Within the kind of recommendations that the government gave a few years ago, plastic paper bags were not included. So actually, technically, they shouldn't really be charging for paper bags. I mean, Morrison's charges 40p, Iceland charges 30p. But you've got kind of food retailers like McDonald's, they don't charge for paper bags. No one else seems to change to charge. So there isn't much uniformity kind of across the board, which is, I think, very unfair.
Honestly, the paper bag thing, as you might have guessed from my introduction there, drives me absolutely bananas. I thought the whole point of this, yeah, single-use plastic, good for the environment and stuff, but can we not take a holistic view of what's good for the environment? And I'm pretty confident making a shed load of paper bags that you just end up chucking away, I would rather pay for a bag. And so if I do buy anything, any bags, I'll buy like the £1 to £5 bags because, well, hopefully it'll encourage me not to use it. But at least you know they last and you can use them for other things. The single-use plastic bin liners, but the paper ones, oh, God, stop. And they don't carry anything and you're holding it and it's just, oh, God, Simon.
I mean, the point that gets missed in some of this, right, and I was a supporter of the plastic bag tax that isn't a tax, is that we were using way too many single-use plastic bags. But actually, plastic in itself is not entirely evil. Plastic is also highly recyclable. And those within the recycling industry, and certainly those within the plastic industry, will be very keen to tell you this and point out to you that in many instances, whilst you have an aversion to plastic, it's a better option than the alternative, potentially a paper bag that falls apart and has no other use. A wine bottle, a glass wine bottle. Glass bottles, everybody loves glass bottles. We can recycle glass, can't you? Put it in the bottle bank. Much heavier, energy intensive, less recyclable than simple plastic. You know, endlessly recyclable glass. I think that is the advantage of glass. And my recycling knowledge is about to hit a limit here, so I'm going to stop talking about it. But I do know that plastic is not necessarily as bad. I also know that sometimes now when you just need a simple plastic bag, it's almost bloody impossible to find one. I'm not longing for the days when I wrote blogs about the plastic bag monster lurking below my sink when you opened it and out spilled all those plastic bags that you just couldn't bring yourself to throw away. What am I keeping them for? But yeah. I do sometimes miss the ability to just find a simple plastic bag to put something in, because often a bag for life is actually too thick and too unwieldy and doesn't do the job. But here again, I will salute another growth icon of the past decade, along with the mad remarketing story, yeah. Decathlon. Decathlon sells these blue, materially, God knows what kind of material it is, bags. But they got a nice big strap on them. They fold up into a nice little thing. You can easily stuff it in your pocket.
Yep.
Very, very strong. You can fit tons of stuff into it. And they are the model for what supermarkets should be flogging you instead of mugging you off for bags for life that are frankly a bit crap.
Agreed. And the bonus is you can go around with your Decathlon bag and free advertising for them. So there you go. And they got mentioned in the pod too. So that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. And if you want to tell us about your favorite plastic bag replacement, where you think the best one is, who beats Decathlon, email us and stick, or come to the comments or tweet us or whatever. Stick the word podcast in the subject line if you email us. Or maybe you're out there and you've got a small business knocking out really good bags that replace plastic bags and you want to, you know, fight the mighty Decathlon and say, hey, promote my business instead. Give us a shout if you do. Send us a bag.
Yeah, absolutely. You can try it out. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs. There's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.